If you're a small business owner, you already know what it takes to keep everything moving. You're juggling customers, invoices, and about 100 decisions every day. Thankfully, taxes don't have to be one more thing on that list. With Intuit TurboTax, you can get your business taxes done for you with a full-service expert. TurboTax matches you with your dedicated tax expert who knows your industry, understands your business write-offs, and gives you the personalized advice your business deserves. Upload your documents right in the app, hand everything off, and still feel like you're in the loop the whole way through. You can even get real-time updates on your expert's progress right in the app, which makes it so much easier to stay on track. And you can get unlimited expert help at no extra cost, even on nights and weekends during tax season. Visit TurboTax.com to get matched with an expert today. Only available with TurboTax full service experts.
And welcome back to Blunt Business. We are starting part two of a two-part episode where we're talking about private equity entering into the cannabis industry, and also the looming $6 billion debt crisis. And previous episode, I'm happy to go and welcome back on the folks of the cannabis practice at Dickinson Wright. I'm here with Scott Crow and Benjamin Stopchick. Scott and Ben, thanks for being back on with us.
Thanks for having us on, Gaston.
Absolutely. So once again, Scott is co-founder of Dickinson Wright's cannabis practice. Has been over 10 years doing this. Extensive experience in corporate mergers and acquisitions, tax law. Ben, experienced litigator, outside general counsel, who he served as that, providing regulatory and transactional-based services to cannabis companies across the U.S. and Canada. So we talked the last episode, just some of the understanding about the environment that has caused private equity to make the cannabis industry a viable option to go ahead and go after the different companies and what they're going to go through. But we need to go and figure out what is it that cannabis companies need to be prepared for once private equity comes in, the common questions or the common misconceptions, we could say, that are out there. Now, one thing I wanted to ask that I wanted to wait until this episode was, we've had a little bit in the cannabis industry where there's been that kind of, you know, the connotation about lending and for having companies come in where social equity comes in. Now, Scott, in the last episode, you mentioned about how there's been the lottery process and how some companies have been able to go and get in and how they've had to go and go through the regulatory process through whichever Bureau of Cannabis Control, Office of Cannabis Management, on how they get their companies licensed. So one of the things was, you know, I go back to an NPR story from, what was it, just before the New York market opened, and think about what was some Chicago private bank that has come in and they're paying 15 to 20% interest on the loans. You have a social equity firm or somebody that gets a social equity license or a card license in New York State. They go through, pay $50,000, a fee that they're never going to get back. And then they have to go ahead and to get the money they need. They might not have the resources to go and get the money they need to go ahead and fund the business, but they have to go through a loan that's going to be a lot. And some of those are not going to be able to get to those loans and pay them off. And, you know, they're not going to have enough capital to go through the regulatory red tape to go through a soft opening and inspections and then finally get to open their shop. So, I mean, there's those kind of things where when you look at that comparison where social equity firms have gone through that kind of rigmarole, what do you say about for those bigger companies that are not, the you know, they're going to go into private equity as opposed to social equity?
I'll jump in a little bit, but I'm more interested in what Ben has to say on this because he's closer to it. But on the social equity piece, in my opinion, the states had a great idea in granting license to those in those minorities that don't have access to capital licenses, but they failed in not coupling it with a program to give them access to capital in order to get these operations propped up. Once they get their license and get their provisional, how are they going to get the capital to build out a dispensary or manufacturing license or cultivation license? That takes serious money. And most, I would say 9 times out of 10, the social equity recipients are not in a position to be able to execute on that license once it's been granted to them. And I think you've seen a number of black eye situations that have made more national news where you have someone with money taking advantage or being accused of taking advantage of social equity license holder because of the position that they're in, lack of sophistication, lack of available counsel to them, all because they're financially constrained. So they can get taken advantage of pretty quickly by someone who's predatory and coming in and really wanting to access their license, but take control of their operations. We've seen some cases of that in Ohio as well, where that was the case and parties ultimately settled. But it was those type of situations that have come up, and I think all states that have social equity programs.
Ben, before you jump in, I want to just make this take as well, that the other mistake I will constantly talk about when it comes to social equity programs, no matter how good it is to help those disenfranchised and, you know, that also been, you know, unnecessarily incarcerated or compromised. The one part was that social equity should have gotten right the first time, and it still doesn't have happened, is legacy operators getting involved in the market. They should have got their own chance equally to get a license and help to curb the black market. But Ben, go ahead.
So, I mean, in Michigan, for instance, legacy operators, like the state made it easier for caregivers to transition into licenses, right? Or tried to. Absolutely, they did. I'm going to hit the social equity piece from a different direction. Like first, and to start off with, right, as a lifelong cannabis user, highly supportive of the concept, right? It is beyond dispute that certain subsectors of American society have been overly punished about their use or enjoyment of cannabis. And it's not fair, and it hasn't been fair for decades. And there's still people in jail right now. Like, I think about the fact that I'm standing here in a law firm helping people sell weed, while there's some guy in a jail cell right now that's in prison for selling weed, right? That's insane. But anyways, the way I want to hit it is that the social equity programs that have been rolled out are fantastic conceptually. Their intentions are good. It breaks down because those folks don't have the cash or business resources to pull off this highly complex business. And the regulations are drafted to protect those people from the people they need to do business with to get the money and resources. For instance, I've represented lenders who want so badly to put money into New York's market, right? You have all these social equity retailers in New York that got this license. They can't get their building. They can't get their lease off. They can't get their build out done. And I have lenders that are chomping at the bit to put money into those, and they can't because the social equity licenses say you can't take a security interest. You can't sue these people if they don't pay you. You cannot underwrite that loan staying compliant with the regulations, right? Because the regulations have made it so challenging to invest in that space and a risk profile because of all the things that you can't do in an effort to protect the social equity applicant from losing their business or being victimized. And so it's just an impossible situation, right? A lot of social equity applicants fail to ever actually execute an opportunity, right? Because they don't have it starting off with. And I haven't seen anybody truly fix that yet. But that's my experience. And you know, on that piece, it's a shame because it should be one of the most important things to get right. And I don't think anybody's exactly done that yet.
No. It's funny that you don't really know the angle the public policymakers are coming at when they're thinking this through, because to Ben's point, you give someone a license, but you make it impossible for them to get access to capital because you're trying to prevent what? Someone who's not on a license having access to the profits of cannabis. And I get that initial angst of we don't want criminals to be part of license operation, because that was typically one of the kickouts. If you were a felon, you couldn't get a cannabis license, which knocked a lot of people out, to Ben's point, that were treated unfairly because they had prior charges for selling cannabis. So it's this push-pull of that, but then you make it so they can't take on the credit. And if that's the public policy we're fighting about today, I get that early on, but we're 10 years apart from that, and you have real banks, real private equity groups that are wanting to lend and participate in these investments, and they can't because of the state regimes. And it doesn't make any sense. Some of these rules you see getting tighter and tighter for the exact situation where they want the actual person of the license to have control of it. And I get all that, but they need the support of a bigger operation in most cases to be successful. And that requires security interests and other things that most states now prohibit. So that brings in the lawyers. When you have to get super complex and you
create these structures to work around these rules, and it gets very expensive very quickly.
It's amazing the stories I've heard over the years from various operators that had to go through the process, especially when social equity came in, and just seeing what they had to go through to get to this point, just to get their operation up. And again, the 2 to 3 year process for some of them, especially in New York State, just to get to the point where they can actually get their operations going. I remember talking to who's now with the Drug Policy Alliance, Kat Packer, and whenever when she's working in Los Angeles, you know, thousands of applicants, and it was just like only with so many resources they have, just to try to get the licensing process through, and it was just grueling and painstaking just to get through. But we're now at this point where, you know, we can go ahead and, you know, continue to talk about the fact that the issues with it, but now we have to prepare for the fact that, okay, we don't, you know, you made a point, Scott, that there's just some points where there's a little, I will call it tone deafness on the part of Congress when they have certain things, or even the presidency. President Biden, when he put out the rule to go ahead and excommunicate all federal cannabis offenses for those that are in jail federally for cannabis offenses, thinking, oh, that was going to be a way to get, you know, people out of jail for cannabis possession or for use. And I was like, well, there's not that many people being charged federally, so that didn't really help much. It was a good gesture, but it really didn't do anything in the long run. That wasn't changing to state by state. And of course, there's those who are going to be complaining about the fact that, well, are we doing reclassification? Why can't we get decriminalization? It's like, it's, you know, you're never going to make everybody satisfied, but at least make some headwinds towards the right direction. But until then, I mean, we have reclassification, executive orders coming in. We have to wait for new administrative law judge, see if the process can get started back up once again, see if the DEA, you know, commissioner's actually going to go ahead and move along and get the process going. We're just waiting for everything here with bated breath. But in the meantime, cannabis companies, their perception by private equity firms, I would imagine, they could see that there's the tag of, well, this company's vulnerable or debt-ridden, and they absolutely need us, so we're going to just jump right into the rescue. Now, there is a staggering market volatility, and, you know, chemist market has been mature, again, over 10 years, but they've had debt defaults. There have been lenders, which can be private equity firms or family offices that are taking borrowers pledged collateral. And, you know, the environment that these private equity companies are going to put themselves into to rescue these cannabis companies, is that the kind of perception they're coming in from? Or do they feel like, you know, these companies have been done well, we just want to go ahead and continue to grow the growth? Or do they feel like they are just coming in with a life raft?
I think private equity doesn't invest to life raft. They come in to buy good businesses and turn them into amazing businesses. So they're looking for positive cash flow businesses. Now, are there lenders out there in the space that lend into as life rafts, like factoring companies and other, like your finance of last resort? Yes, but those are more what I call your predatory lenders, where the expectation is that you're going to fail and they're the last money in. So they're going to be lending to you on a very expensive basis, which if you fail, they will end up controlling your assets. Now, are there investors out there in the country that is the exact playbook of the fund? Yeah. It's funds that come in as a last resort, and it's a loan-to-own type program. You see a lot in the resort worlds, golf courses, things that have been overbuilt. It's usually the third owner of that asset makes money off of it. The first two lose their ass because of the cost of building this goes way overboard. And you could run in the same thing in cannabis. Cultivation facility runs over by, you know, 5 to 10 million in costs of building. You've now built an asset that's going to lose money because your debt structure wasn't accounted for when you were putting together your pro formas. So surprises are kind of routine in the cannabis sector.
And I want to say this as well, and I might not have said it in the first part, but I do want to take the benefit of the doubt and say, I know that there's good private equity companies that are going to come in with good intentions. I don't want to dismiss that or discourage that, but I am asking the questions about that there are the fears that some of these companies are going to have if a private equity company comes a calling. And that's where I want to go and come from, just to kind of dispel those rumors, myths, anything that's like that. Just lay it out there and you're going to give us, you know, the real truth about it. Now, the other part is that,
Go ahead. No, okay. This is like real world experience, last 2 years of my professional working life. Okay. Again, the set and setting here is that the private equity firm is coming in because they don't have a choice, okay? They have $10 million, $15 million, $20 million out on this cannabis company. They've been in default on their loan repayments for 6 months, 9 months, a year, right? They don't have the cash flow to spin off that interest and principal payment and pay their employees and pay their property taxes and pay their licensing fees and pay their wildly unfair federal taxes, pay workers' comp, pay all this other stuff they can't write off, their executives. They can't. It doesn't mathematically make sense. So the lenders come in, okay? Most of the time, the founding members of the cannabis company have some sort of personal guarantee on the loan. Even if they're normal people of normal financial means, there's a PG just to make sure that you keep them honest and invested in, you know, taking care of their loan and lender. So a lender comes in, and the way it usually goes, in my experience, is you go to the founders and you go, hey guys, like, I'm sorry, right? This isn't working anymore and we're out of time. If you make this hard on us, right? If you fight us on this, like, your personal guarantee starts to put you personally at risk for your failed business, which sucks. But we can't do this by ourselves. We know that you're a good person, and we know that you tried to run a good business, and we know that this isn't your fault because the commodity price of the thing you make and sell has gone down 70% in 3 years, right?
Yeah.
And so here's the deal, right? And oftentimes you get some sort of arrangement short of a receivership, short of some court proceeding that says, like, we're taking the building back, we're going to stand it up in a new company, but we want you to be a part of that or run it because we need still the OG cannabis guy or just the dude who was committed to this place and lives in the area and knows the market. And there's like a business arrangement, right? Maybe it's a job. Maybe they get an equity kicker on the back end. So it's really like red pill, blue pill, right? My advice to an operator is, if your lender's at your door because you are not paying them and you're not gonna, right? You have to make an early decision. Like, are you going to go with the flow and try to be helpful to their effort, or are you going to fight it? Understanding that if you fight it, they're going to fight you back, right? Which isn't necessarily going to turn out great. And I have it both ways. I have operators that I've put multi-million dollar judgment liens on because they took the red pill and made it hard on us for a year. And I have other operators that now work at the same facility that they used to own and have a good job there, and the lender now owns it, or some affiliate of the lender now owns it, and they're working together as a team. And it's just going to have to kind of be like, what, you know, how are you going to play that when they show up and tell you that you're out of time and that, you know, the loan's getting qualified?
I want to go on.
And if there is.
Oh, go ahead, Scott.
Go ahead. I was going to say, back to your point of the life raft, if you're going to get a life raft investment, it's likely to come from your existing investor, where they are willing to put some more money in to try and right the ship, because there's a thesis and there's a path out. But I wouldn't rely on new money coming in as your money of last resort. It's more likely going to come from your existing investment pool.
So I want to get into now, once private equity gets involved, and now I used the radio industry as an example last time. I'm going to just take it as an example because of what I saw of what private equity would do, you know, depending on what they might decide to do. One of the first courses of action they could look at is, well, what's the collateral that they have and what can we do to kind of take away what is not necessary? Let's streamline the process, streamline the resources. So, for instance, the radio industry, well, they used to own their buildings. No, they took them, sold them, and now they're leasing them. And then when they had their towers to transmit AM/FM transmissions, they sold the towers and now they're leasing them. So they're trying to take some of the cost away to pay down the debt or down the loan. Now, in this case, we're talking about facilities, equipment, regulated inventory, sums that would result in an acceptable loan write down. In that process, tell me about where you come from there and to prepare for that part, if that's going to be the first thing they might go and do.
Here's the interesting thing. Private equity typically likes to invest in operations. They don't like to own assets that are related to the business, not part of the core business.
Right.
So to me, it makes sense that they would have sold off the real estate because they're not in the business of owning and operating real estate. They want to operate radio stations. Now, funny thing about cannabis operators, and I won't say it's the majority, but a large number of cannabis operators in the country have already done that. They've sold off.
their real estate and entered into sale-leaseback transactions because they couldn't afford or couldn't find money to build their cultivation center or their manufacturing center. So these businesses, to this point, have really skinnied down their assets, which makes them a very difficult operator to lend to because you're looking at straight commercial financing, which is based off cash flow and EBITDA. And it's really an there is security interest taken in the assets of the operations, but unlike a real estate asset where you're lending 80% of the value in, if that asset gets sold, you have a good shot at getting paid off. In a cannabis operation, the value of that equipment is nowhere near the amount of the loan that you have provided as an investment into that entity. So it creates a different risk profile, again, which heightens the risk and the returns. And that's why you see very aggressive interest rates and coupons on investments and returns, because they're trying to account for that lack of availability of assets to really make them whole, which then goes to Ben's point. What do we do with it? Well, we're going to have to operate it. So we have to hire back the people. They couldn't pay us back, find a new operator, or we're going to form a new company and digest the assets that way. But again, it leads back to that push-pull is, what are you going to do with all these assets? Because selling the equipment is not going to make your loan whole.
We're going to go to commercial break. When we come back, I want to take more into the direction here about the involvement of private equity for a cannabis company, what they might be worried about, the narrative that might come with it, and how it really is. We're here again with Scott Crowe and Benjamin Stomchek of Dickinson Wright. Website is Dickinson-Wright. You could say hash, you could say dash. It's, you know, there's a little hyphen in the middle of DickinsonWright.com. Take a look at the website as we go to commercial break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Bump Business. I'm here with Scott Crowe and Benjamin Stomchek from Dickinson Wright, their cannabis practice. Now, the other part that I look in on the next set after resources are going to be evaluated and assets and what they're going to do as a private equity company or a firm coming in to invest into a cannabis company. Benjamin, you mentioned the part about the operators still wanted to go in and hold on and retain some of the talent that was there from the start of the company, the OGs, if you will. But then, I mean, how many times have we seen that happen with private equity where the lenders become the operators? The situation where aggressive lenders might seek to profit from cannabis entrepreneurs, forcing to assume operations and become the operators themselves. Tell me about where that comes from. And, you know, is that something that we need to be aware of? And that is that a possibility?
I don't think so. I don't think that there's a bunch of private equity guys that are like around a table like, we got the loan, but now we want to touch the plant and grow the weed ourselves, right? That's not what's happening. What's happening is they're like, shit, right? Like, we got $10 million out on this loan portfolio. They're not going to pay us back. We can't resell the building for 10 or 5 or even 3 right now. And we have to lean into operations and try to run it and hope that the market improves. And then they say, well, we have better back office, we have more sophisticated business people, we have probably some additional money to weather the storm longer than the competition in that market. And what they don't have is a person who lives in that market that knows what's going on and is 15 minutes away from the grow and can go work there and has some allegiance to the cause. So that's where you see this marriage of the operator and the lender for their shared benefit, which is now the same, right?
Well, Benjamin, I want to make this point because I'm not saying it's going to be something that happens immediate. I think this is something down the line 3 to 5 years. In the radio industry, we had radio folks that were still working on the operations end, but they were eventually going to be pushed out because the private equity folks found out, oh, we got to learn the industry for like last 5-10 years. Now we're going to jump in and, you know, get this person off because we don't want to pay their pension or we don't want to pay a larger salary. We're just going to put somebody else in there as a suit to take over.
What typically happens, Brasco, with private equity in a normal investment is if they go in and assess that there's gaps in the personnel that operates, they have partners, executives that they have done or deals with that are kind of on the sidelines. So an executive for hire that they'll insert into the operations. So sometimes you'll get a CFO or a CEO that's been in another successful investment that they made that has done well. They call them up and say, can you get involved in this business? I think if you see private equity starting to operate these businesses, it won't be any of their personnel directly. They'll be out hiring executives to step in and run the operations if they don't believe that the existing operators can carry the company forward. Now, they may have a role within the organization, but they may not be your C-level executive team that carries it forward.
I agree with that. And I understand your temporal distinction. Yes, if the market in Michigan, for instance, flattens out and the price of weed goes up to something where you can make money and 280E goes away because of rescheduling, are there going to be enterprising businesses that are trying to pick up assets at a discount and go? Yes. Are you going to have founders who are absolutely exhausted with this, right? It has been harder for them than they ever thought it would be, and they've never been liquid or felt safe since the first day they tried to get their license to today. So not one time, right? Like, people are losing years on their life at this point trying to just weather all the ups and downs of this industry.
Honestly, I would be curious to find out, Ben, if you asked someone that was growing illegally and became a legal grower, whether they regret their decision.
I know I have
PC. Especially now that most states, the first step they do is decriminalize it. So you don't need a license. You just need the equipment that the other operators have. So you see the same illegal products aren't a bag of weed anymore. It's, you can get anything from your corner dealer. You can get vapes. You can get, now, whether it's safe or not is a different question. But
I have friends that say, man, I was rich when I was trapping, and then I got into the legal metric market, and it's just been terrible ever since, right? And that's facts. But the last point I want to make is, if the business is failing and it's not doing well, right, even when the market starts to level out and, like, outside forces start to see opportunity, which I don't believe is the case right now in the markets I'm spending my time in, then yeah. But if the business starts to do better and private equity comes in and says, hey, we see a longer term play here, hopefully, man, that operator's getting cashed out. Maybe not like buy an island and a helicopter cashed out the way they imagined in 2019 when they started. That might be the first time that they get liquid in 7 years, right? They haven't paid their friends and family investors, haven't seen a dollar back. Everybody's super pissed. Yeah. So in some way, you know, if you
nowadays
can, it's a blessing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, entrepreneurs, I want to speak for them and just say that this trend could mean that, you know, for cannabis entrepreneurs, it's going to be a pretty rough, and they're going to see that the assets they've accrued are going to get sold off. And tell me about the broader message it sends to the industry about financing risks.
Everybody knows that everybody messed up. Right. Like, look at, like, sitting here today, looking back at that loan package you signed 4 or 5 years ago and the interest carry and everything else. Like, there was a lot of people who, you know, should have been. And that's not just the operators. That's the lenders. The lenders are sad they gave that loan 4 or 5 years ago, too. Right. Nobody is really stoked about it at all. The message is, I don't really know what the message is right now. People are just kind of...
These are smart people that got it wrong. These weren't green people that hadn't made investments before. These were investment advisors. They were backed by analysts looking at this. So it wasn't just we guessed and missed. There was a lot of thought that went into these, what the market was going to look like for purpose of making these investments. Everyone was wrong. So for entrepreneurs and those... Go ahead.
Oh, no, I wanted to go and take us to a commercial break because there's more we're going to go and talk about here. We're going to wrap things up about that looming $6 billion debt crisis we talked about already before. We're going to go more into that and discuss more. I'm here once again with the folks at Dickinson Rice, Cannabis Practice, Scott Crow, Benjamin Stopcheck here on Blunt Business. Back with final questions after this. We're back with final questions. I'm here with Scott Crow, Benjamin Stopcheck with the Cannabis Practice at Dickinson Wright. Website is dickinson-wright.com. And we'll let people know right here at the end of this episode how you can go ahead and get in touch with them and what they can provide to you in terms of services. And you should look them up. So taking it from a strip of quartz, they make the point about the changes for reclassification and what could come from this and, you know, how there's a lot of companies, not just with the debt that they have that's looming up, but also the amount of taxes that they owe. So when you have Section 280E, you know, there's been tax breaks effectively for 60 to 90% for cannabis companies. Between 2019 and September 2025, the largest multi-state operators have paid just $600 million of roughly $2.6 billion owed in taxes, according to Green Wave Advisors. And the unpaid liabilities keep piling up on balance sheets, creating a slow-motion financial crisis for companies that are technically profitable. And we've put the word at $6 billion. Tell me how that particular numbers come across. And aside from the tax issue, what are the other things that have accrued debt for these companies?
Well, I'll go first. Well,
go. Yeah, look, the IRS tax liability as a whole, I kind of treat it differently from the debt piece, in that the IRS is its own special creature, and there are tons of rules and regulations around there, the IRS collection process, and smart operators can take advantage of those and use the IRS as a potential unwilling lender into their operations, which is what's occurring, because they can't pay the tax. They can't afford to do it because they aren't technically profitable businesses. They're losing money. They just don't get the benefit of their deductions to show the IRS that they're not profitable. So there's that piece. And then on the $6 billion gridlock of debt that's coming due, I think the majority of that is going to get solved by the existing lending groups that are lending into those companies, whether it's a rotation to different businesses or a re-upping by the same existing lender. Because of the lack of choices in the marketplace, you're going to be forced to do that. And the advice we've always given to our clients is, as soon as you close a financing round, you should be out raising capital again or figuring out who your replacement is going to be for that partner, because that 3 to 5 year gap, it's going to happen really quickly. Like 3 years is going to pass quickly, and then you're going to be behind. And if hope is your plan, it's a bad plan. And my clients do that in normal industry sectors as well. When they close a banking finance round of a material amount of money, they're usually back at the market within a quarter, starting to explore where they're going to get their capital from for their next, you know, acquisition or refinancing or whatever it might be. So it should be something that is constantly on your mind. And I think a lot of cannabis operators made the mistake of thinking, we have enough. This is going to carry us through. We're going to be operating. We're going to be profitable. Look, back in the day when everyone was throwing out 60 and 70% profit margins, seemed like an easy task to achieve. You know, it's risky, it's regulatory, but we're selling weed and making 70% margins, there should be plenty of money to pay everyone, and that's not played out.
So one of the examples I want to give is the state of California and the amount of taxes they're paying right now. So as of October last year, they now have a 15% state excise tax, which is another increase from gross receipts from retail sales. Then you have state and local taxes, which can be between 7.25% to 10.75%. And then the local taxes going in there. So most likely state excise, sales tax, local tax could exceed 40% of the original retail price, which is why the black market is out there as it is. And,
yep,
you know, I mean, there's only so much that's out there. And there's other things you could do when it comes to vendor compensation programs to let retailers retain 20% of the excise tax for specific approved businesses. But again, okay, little kickbacks here and there, that's not going to help enough. But there are also all these companies are getting all taxed to death, and the black market's not helping at all.
Yeah, I mean, on the IRS piece, right, like they're not foreclosing, right? Like how many of us have read news stories like us hits MSO and takes back its Pennsylvania facility? The IRS knows that it's not fair, and they're just milking
people. By that, they're prohibited from doing it, because if you go they look at your business, you have nothing to pay them. Well, they can't force you to pay, and they can't force you to close your business, so they're stuck in limbo as well.
Right.
So the IRS, in my opinion, is easier to deal with, quite honestly, than lenders, because there are specific rules and regulations that you can take advantage of as a taxpayer to protect yourself and your business.
That's right.
You don't have to anymore.
The state taxes are different because the state taxes are always tied to the licenses. If you don't pay your taxes, then the state regulatory agency that gives you your license eventually doesn't give you your license. And yeah, I mean, Michigan just threw 24% excise tax over. It's blowing people's minds over here where I'm at right now. Like people do not know how to handle that. And I think that, you know, that's not exactly great policy, but I also think that government moves slow, right? So when they were starting to be talk about taxing these industries more, they were looking at historic numbers, like back when things were better, right? They're not up to speed with the beat of the market, right? Like, then say, oh, these people all have no margin. They're all, you know, their businesses are already failing. Let's squeeze them harder, right? I feel like there's a lag in tax policy from a state standpoint and real world, like, you know, what is it like to be in the business? And that's creating this weird concept where they think there's more money to get out of this. They're just going to, it's killing the industries that they're overtaxing. Like, you know, it's absolutely killing them.
Final question for both of you. When companies are starting to feel a pinch and they're going to have some issues where they're now looking in the horizon, they might have foreclosures, receiverships, business failures, forced operational adjustments. When these things start looking to be reality, I mean, how soon? And what should these companies be doing if they're starting to feel compromised or they're starting to feel they're hitting the danger zone? You know, what should they be doing to go in and find help or relief from private equity or just some other kind of investment relief out there?
My advice is that if they have a existing lender or investor, is to talk with them and be transparent. The worst thing, in my opinion, you can do is hide from them, start to play because you're either ashamed or, you know, you're not able to pay the debt. It's a natural thing to try and avoid people that you owe money to. But in this instance, your best outcome is likely to lean into it well ahead of before you hit the point of no return. So understanding your financials, paying attention to them, and understanding the direction your business is heading is important so that you can work with your lender and potentially save your business. Because the other result of ignoring them, playing those games, they're going to force to do what Ben said is bring the heavy, and it's going to be a different pill that you get to take.
I will add to being super transparent with your lender, opening up the books, showing why you are doing your best and why it's functionally impossible in the world that we live in to make that all work. Also, make sure you're being honest with your investors. Most of these companies had a seed round of initial equity people, sometimes friends and family, and they use that money to prop up the business enough to justify the big loan to build the facility. All those equity people are going to get washed out, right? Or have not seen any returns even of their initial investment for years past when they thought it was going to be. And going quiet and turtling when it's not going good and you know it's not going to get better is going to just inflame them and create more enemies, cause you more trouble, right? It being honest with people and just saying we have done everything we were supposed to do and the world has still not worked out for us is best practice, I think. Anything else starts to make it look like it's your fault. And that's the last thing that you want the leadership of an operator to take out.
I really love this conversation. We've gotten so many takeaways out of this. And I think we really put a lot of information out there just for companies just to be aware. And I feel like I've learned quite a bit just from what both of you have expressed here about the private equity process and, you know, seeing that coming into the cannabis industry now. And for those companies that, you know, they're still trying to struggle to get themselves away from debt or out of debt altogether. And this is all interesting to me. I think it's a conversation we can continue to have. For now, we're going to go ahead and, you know, wrap things up. But before we do that, Scott and Benjamin, I want to give you a chance to go ahead and just tell us real quickly about the law firm, Dickinson-Wright.com, DICKINSON-WRIGHT.com. Take a minute to go and talk to listeners about, you know, what you provide in terms of services in the cannabis practice and what you're able to go and provide to those that would love to go and reach out to you.
I'll wrap up by saying we've been in the space for going on 13 years with over 50 lawyers throughout North America that are either practicing full-time or part-time in the cannabis space, and it's a soup-to-nuts practice. So we can walk you through startup all the way to exit and everything else in between. So again, regardless of the state you're in, please give us a call. Ben, anything you want to add?
No, I think that pretty much sums it up.
No, I think what I can say is that you want to get with Scott and Ben because obviously not just do you have the understanding of the law, but also the business experience and the acumen, understanding how this process all works. I think it's all very important. So Scott and Benjamin, thank you so much for being on Bump Business for the last couple episodes. This has been a great conversation. I hope we get to do something like this again.
Thank you for having us.
And thanks for having us.
Hey, I appreciate it. Pleasure. Really wonderful conversation. And with that said, we're going to go ahead and wrap up Blunt Business. And that's been a great episode. I hope to hear from you in the comments. You see it on Spotify or on YouTube or wherever else. Feel free to go ahead and chime in. Any questions you want to have. But in the meantime, we will follow this story along here on Blunt Business. And we'll talk to you next time.